Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pax Britannica, the Scottish Revolution interview series,
The Covenanters in Restoration Scotland, with Dr. Alan Kennedy.
Welcome to the Pax Britannica Scottish Revolution interview series. Today I'm thrilled to speak with Dr. Alan Kennedy, lecturer in history at the University of Dundee, project manager of the Scottish Privy Council project, and consultant editor of History Scotland. Dr. Kennedy's research focuses on the social and political history of early modern Scotland, with a particular focus on the latter half of the 17th century. Much of his work has been on Restoration Scotland, between the return of Charles II and the overthrow of his brother, James II, and I'm happy to speak with him today. Dr. Alan Kennedy, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
No problem. Thanks very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Most of the people I've spoken to in the interview series, they're specialists of the period of the Scottish Revolution, or at least the earlier Scottish Revolution, but your period is later in the century. I'd love to pick your brains about the legacy of these events further down the line when, because, you know, Scottish history isn't all calm and placid after 1660. Lots more stuff happens, and I have to wonder whether the legacy, the heritage, the memory, popular memory even, of the revolution had a role to play in that. So the Restoration occurs in 1660. In the immediate aftermath, some members of the Covenant leadership are executed. I'm thinking like Argyll. How did the Restoration regime handle ordinary Scots when Charles II returned? And what about, were Covenanters suppressed?
I suppose that depends on your time scale. I mean, the initial impulse of the Restoration regime, Charles II's regime, when it comes back in 1660, is to make examples of some of these covenanting leaders. You mentioned Argyll. Archibald Johnson of Warriston is another one who, by the time he's executed, is a very old and frail man, but that doesn't save him. So there's that element of it, of punishing the more prominent individuals. As for ordinary Scots, however, Charles II's government makes initially very little effort to impose punishments on them, for one very good reason, I think, which is that if Charles II had decided to execute everybody who had cleaved to the Covenant, who had fought for the Covenant in the 1640s and into the 1650s, he would have had nobody left in Scotland. Virtually everybody had been a Covenanter to some degree. So, you know, reality dictates that Charles II has to allow an indemnity to pass. However, as I say, he doesn't quite go the whole hog of just forgiving and forgetting everything. When the Act of Indemnity is passed by Charles II's first Scottish Parliament, there are a few absolute exceptions. So people like Argyll, Warriston, the ones I mentioned earlier who get executed. There's also a very, very long list of slightly less prominent people who will be granted indemnity, but are required to pay a fine beforehand. And there's a suspicion at the time, and I think it's a very justified suspicion, that that Charles II is using this. And I say Charles II, I really mean his ministers in Scotland, particularly the Earl of Middleton, are using this to extract revenue, essentially. It's not really about indemnity. It's a bit of a wheeze to force people to pay up and swell the Crown's coffers a little bit. So I think that's the basic approach that Charles II takes. For most ordinary folk, it's just let's forget about it and move on. For the very prominent Covenanting leaders, particularly ones whom Charles II himself had a very difficult relationship with in his first reign in the early 1650s, Argyll is the best example of that. I wouldn't blame Charles II if he loathed Argyll with a passion, given how domineering Argyll's behaviour towards him had been in 1650-1. And then in the middle, there's this group of gentry who get fines imposed on them, some of which were probably paid, some of which likely were not. So we have this kind of threefold approach to indemnity that Charles II takes, and that's worked itself out by around about the middle of the 1660s. And that process of punishing is finished by that point, I think.
Presumably, by that point, everyone's fine and dandy, and there's no problems whatsoever. That's not the case. I wonder if you could expand a little bit more on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be lovely if everything had been wonderful and peaceful. But it's not. I mean, there are lots of little problems that are likely to come around when you've got a massive political political revolution, which has wider ramifications like the Restoration. So there are individuals who don't feel like they're properly rewarded. MacDonald Glengarry, for example, wants to be made an Earl. He wants to become Earl of Ross. He thinks that his activities on behalf of Charles II in the Glencairn's Rising in the mid-1650s merit something like that. He doesn't get it and he's a little bit annoyed. So there's lots of that. And there are other sort of niggling problems as well. The big issue, of course, though, and I think this is what you're referring to, is that by 1662, the restoration is going so well for the government, it's managing to restore royal authority so fully that it decides to go the whole hog and reintroduce episcopacy, Episcopalianism as the form of the Church of Scotland. Now, the reason that's a problem I'll come on to in a moment, but I think it's worth establishing, first of all, that it's a little bit of a surprise because most people, when Charles II returns in 1660, and this probably includes Charles II himself, had likely assumed that they would have to retain some degree of Presbyterianism, that completely restoring episcopacy was probably not possible. And a lot of more moderate Presbyterians convince themselves that Charles has no intention of doing this, of restoring episcopacy. And as I say, Charles probably had been cautious about what he could achieve. But particularly under the guidance of Middleton, who is his commissioner to the Scottish Parliament in 1661 and 1662, we get this full restoration of diocesan episcopacy. So bishops come back and are charged with running the church just as they had been before the Covenanting Revolution. And obviously, for a lot of people who had become big supporters of a Presbyterian ecclesiastical system as it had developed after 1638, this is unacceptable. And that's why we see a very large exodus of people from the Church of Scotland, particularly ministers, who are required as part of this church settlement to demonstrate their willingness to accept an Episcopalian system. Those that are not willing to do that, probably amounts to about a third of the ministers in the church who are in that position of not being willing to make those declarations, they are forced out of the church and out of their livings. And that obviously is a big problem at the time. It causes a lot of upheaval, a lot of tension, but it also underpins virtually the entirety of the rest of the Restoration. We can think of the Restoration, Charles II's reign up to 1685, and then James VII's at least up to 1687, and actually towards the end of his right to the end of his reign as well. We can think of that whole period as an extended exercise in trying to work out the implications of that restoration of episcopacy. But there is no doubt that at the time of it passing in 1662, already it's very clear that this is a major upheaval. And it has significant implications, which will dominate Charles's reign for as long as he remains king.
Are you referring to the so-called killing times?
Eventually. The killing times, this wonderful phrase that's kind of invented by Presbyterian propagandists really in the 18th century, looking back on Charles II's reign. The killing times are in some ways the culmination of this process, and they really are concentrated in the half decade after 1679, so the last few years of Charles II's reign in particular, and arguably the first couple of James VII. But it takes us a long time to get to the killing time. What we have instead for throughout the 1660s and 1670s is a process of what's sometimes called oscillation on the government's part between repression and conciliation. Mm-hmm. And what that means is they it has been suggested that we can think of Charles II's government in particular swinging between trying to tempt these ministers back into the church, trying to get them to take up their livings again and preach within the structures of the Church of Scotland again, under conditions. They're not allowed to utter treasonous words, for example, stuff like that. That in particular is we see happening in the so-called indulgences. The first in 1669, which tries to bring some of these ministers back. A second one in 1672, which tries to bring a few more. There's a third one in 1679, which we might come to a bit later because it's slightly separate. But as well as that, as well as trying to tempt these ministers back into the church, the repression element that I mentioned involves the government trying to clamp down on what it sees as militant Presbyterian nonconformity. And that usually takes the form of holding illegal prayer meetings, either in private households, so you'll get a Presbyterian inclined individual will hold a prayer meeting, invite one of these ministers, perhaps, who was ejected from the church, to come and preach as a Presbyterian in his household, and other people might come along. That would be a house conventicle. Or, and this is the bit that the government's really worried about, the so-called field conventicles. And this is where you do the same thing, but outdoors. So you'll get a minister, an ejected minister, to come along and preach outdoors. And the problem with these field conventicles is they can get really big. You can get lots of people coming and listening to these exiled, to these ejected ministers. And the government sees this as a challenge to its authority, because obviously these are people who were operating outside the monolithic, what's supposed to be the monolithic Church of Scotland structures. It also sees this as a fundamental problem of law and order, because these field conventicles, the government tends to see them as disorderly, tends to see them as breeding sedition, tends to see them as being likely to lead to rebellion. And so the natural response on the part of Charles II's government is to try and repress them, to break up these conventicles as they happen, to try and use force or harsh legislation to ensure that these things never take place in the first place. And over the 1660s and 1670s, we see the government gradually, I think, getting less and less patient with these conventicles, and getting harsher and harsher in repression. And most notoriously, the so-called Clanking Act of 1670, which threatens death to any minister who is caught preaching to one of these field conventicles. This is one of the examples that's held up as the government really doubling down on a repressive approach to these religious nonconformists. But it only gets really bad, gets into the killing time after the Covenanter Rebellion of 1679, which gives the government a tremendous shock. It's actually not a gigantic rebellion, and it's put down fairly quickly, but nonetheless it gives, in a wider context of lots of things going wrong around about 1678-9 across Charles II's kingdoms, it causes all sorts of fear. And then in the 1680s, the government begins getting even more repressive towards Covenanters. The Covenanters respond in various ways, which we might get into later on. But it's that period that comes to be known as the killing time, because it involves things like summary executions, like not lots of people, but some Presbyterians being killed while field conventicles are being scattered. All these kind of things mean that the 1680s looks even more repressive than the previous 20 odd years, which is why I think it tends to be zoned in on by these Presbyterian historians writing after 1700 as the period of peak repression. So as I say, it's the most intense phase, but in some ways can also be thought of as the culmination of a process that had been going on really since the moment that Charles II's government decided to restore episcopacy in 1662.
I think that makes a lot of sense. It's hard to see a government going from 0 to 60, from 0 being peaceful to 60 being summary executions during a crackdown. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense that this is, like you say, a culmination and the government slowly getting less and less patient with it. So you mentioned that the Covenanters responded to these things. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that.
There's a couple of things to say there. The first is that in the early phase of Charles II's reign, while this process of repression is gaining ground, we see a particular intensification of that in the sort of towards the mid-1660s in the context of war with the Dutch and all sorts of other issues going on across Charles II's kingdoms. The government sort of cracks down a little bit more around about 1665-6, and that sparks a rebellion, the so-called Pentland Rising. Starting in the southwest, and we end up with a sort of small band of Covenanting rebels sort of marching up towards Edinburgh, where they're defeated in a battle by the government in the Pentland Hills, hence the name Pentland Rising. Not a particularly big rising, but it's a nice example of the way that there is a tendency to sort of push back when the government's getting too repressive. That happens again in the late 1670s. Again, we've had a period of increasing stringency on the part of the government from the mid-1670s onwards, particularly exemplified by the so-called Highland Host. This is an attempt by the Duke of Lauderdale, who is Charles II's chief minister in Scotland for much of his reign. He gathers a militia of about 8,000 men, some of them from the Highlands, hence the name Highland Host, although it's largely the Highland fringe, the southern fringe of the Highlands, but also militia units from elsewhere in Scotland. And this force is sent down to the southwest of Scotland at the start of 1678 to extract free quarter. Basically, it's there to try and force people, Covenanters in the southwest Scotland, to be peaceable and to stop attending field conventicles and to start behaving themselves as the government sees it. It doesn't work. No great shock. These kind of approaches often don't. So what we get instead, partly in response to the Highland Host, but also just as a more general response to government policy, is an increasing radicalisation of some of the more hardline Covenanters, beginning to harden their rhetoric. The most famous example of this is the so-called Cameronians, a small group of radical Covenanters around Richard Cameron is their leader, who begin saying things like Charles II is a tyrant, he's no true king, we're at war with him, fairly radical language. And that fringe of radical Covenanters becomes noisier and better organised as we get into the 1680s. And it's partly this radical fringe, but also a repeat of the dynamic we saw around about the Pentland Rising, of just repression causing a spring back, that we get another Covenanter rebellion in 1679. And that's sparked off by the assassination of the Archbishop of St Andrews in May 1679, which is in many ways a coincidence. The assassins, the people who murdered James Sharp, the Archbishop, had sort of not been intending to murder him, but they happened to come across him as he was traveling near St Andrews in his coach and dragged him from it, stabbed him to death.
As you do
indeed. and that sparks off another Covenanter rebellion, as I mentioned earlier on in 1679, which is not particularly extensive, nor does it last very long. It only lasts about a month before it is put down by government forces. But the government interprets this as evidence of increasing radicalization and increasing sedition on the part of these hardline Covenanters, and begins this process of imposing the killing time. The Covenanters then respond by, or this fringe of Covenanters, because actually I think most Presbyterians by the time we get into the 1680s have more or less made their sort of grudging peace with Charles II's regime, but this core is entirely the wrong word, this fringe of hardline Covenanters has not, and is getting more and more radical, is getting more and more vociferous in its rhetoric, ultimately leading to what's called the United Societies, this kind of umbrella group of radical covenanters who persist throughout the 1680s up until the reign of James VII. But I think it's important to underline, as I hinted at a moment ago, that while we're seeing this process of radicalization, of doing things like declaring war on Charles II, of declaring him a tyrant, all that stuff, this fringe is getting more radical, but also, I think, smaller and tighter. So we have this process of radicalization, which is also hiving off the more extreme Covenanters from mainstream dissenting Presbyterians, which is one of the reasons I think we see many of these mainstream Presbyterians grudgingly coming over to accept the church settlement after the rebellion of 1679. I think it's clear to these people that they're not going to change the church settlement. And anyway, they don't want to be associated with these radical Covenanters who, in their view, and in Charles II's view, and most people's views, I suspect, are saying pretty radical, borderline crazy things by the time we get to the 1680s. So it's a very complicated and fragmented response we have on the part of the Presbyterian groupings, which I think is constantly shot through with this division between some Presbyterians willing to make an accommodation with Charles II and some absolutely being unwilling to do so. And that label Covenanter increasingly, I think, becomes associated with those radical groups, which might explain why when we get to the Revolution, which we may come to later, Covenanting does not come back, even as Presbyterianism does as the official religion of Scotland.
So you've already mentioned that Charles II brings back the bishops. You mentioned the Earl of Middleton and his role as commissioner. Did Charles try and turn the clock back to the pre-revolutionary system, or did he at least try and keep some of the covenantal reforms, at least the ones that were proven useful?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those classic responses of yes and no, because the Restoration Settlement, as it's worked out by about 1663, is really interesting because on paper and in rhetoric and in ethos, it's fundamentally conservative. It's about let's go back to what was happening before 1637-38. So when Parliament is re-established, it's re-established along the lines of Charles I's Parliament rather than the Covenanting Parliament. So that means things like having the so-called Lords of the Articles mm-hmm. back. And that's a drafting committee which had, under Charles I and his predecessors, had been responsible for drafting legislation and then presenting it to the Scottish Parliament just to vote on masse. That had been done away with by the Covenanters. It's brought back by Charles II. And I think that's a nice signal of the way that his government is intending to model itself on Charles I's government, not the Covenanters, and also a signal of its desire for control, because the whole point of the Lords of the Articles is it's a really powerful tool for controlling what goes on in Parliament. And in all sorts of other ways, Charles II's government is trying to show itself to be a conservative regime. So it does things like it restores the patchwork of legal jurisdictions that had existed under Charles I, which had, and actually persisted into the Covenanting period as well, but it's a chaotic jumble of legal jurisdictions that makes no sense at all, is nonetheless restored wholesale to the way it had been before the Revolution. Procedurally as well, Parliament goes back to the way it had been before, not just the Lords of the Articles, but in all sorts of other ways. We have the same thing going on in terms of civil law. So the Court of Session comes back. It had been done away with by Cromwell, and so on and so on. So it looks like Charles II's government is going right back to the way it had been before. And indeed, we end up getting that underlined by the so-called Act Recessory, which is passed in 1662 by the Scottish Parliament, which just wholesale annuls every Act of Parliament that's been passed in Scotland since 1633. So basically everything that had happened in the previous 30-odd years, although Parliament hadn't existed in the 1650s, but nonetheless, all that was just gone. We are back to the early reign of Charles I. So that looks really conservative. And with that comes things like the restoration of the nobility to a position of clear preeminence in politics, which arguably had been challenged during the 1630s and 40s. So all of Charles II's major ministers are noblemen. People like the Earl of Middleton, people like the Duke of Lauderdale, the Earl of Tweeddale, the Earl and later Duke of Rothes, all of these people who dominate his government are noblemen. A couple of exceptions later on, but we'll complicate things. So all that looks really conservative. However, I think it is really important to acknowledge that in some ways, the government sort of quietly accepts that some things that the Covenanters had done were actually better. The most obvious example of that is tax.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that had really annoyed Charles I, James VI, nearly any Scottish monarch before that, was the inadequacy of the revenue that they got from Scotland through taxation, especially. So Charles II's regime kind of quietly retains a lot of the tax innovations that the Covenanters had brought in, particularly by retaining the two main taxes the Covenanters had brought in, the so-called excise tax, so an excise on foreign imports, which Charles II's first Parliament grants to him for the rest of his life, just in perpetuity, that you will always have the excise tax. So immediately giving him a permanent tax income that hadn't accrued to previous monarchs. And then later in the 1660s, after grubbing around a little bit to try and find if there was other ways to raise revenue, Charles II's regime then reintroduces the so-called assessment, so a land tax that had been pioneered by the Covenanters around about 1645, which is just brought back in and becomes the basis for most public taxation throughout Charles II's reign. And equally importantly, that taxation becomes de facto permanent. Previously, under previous Stuart kings, the assumption had been that monarchs only taxed for short periods of time for particular purposes. So if they're going to war or something like that, or if they've got to pay for a wedding or whatever, you could impose a tax for a brief period of time. Under Charles II, that rhetoric of taxation is temporary persists, but in reality, once one temporary tax has expired, a new temporary tax is immediately imposed. And these are for periods of about 5 years at a time or what have you. So effectively, we have permanent taxation, which had been a covenanting innovation, and it's quietly accepted by Charles II's government. So that's a nice example of the way that we have a restoration settlement which looks conservative, but which is, when it is convenient, and when I say convenient, I mean convenient for the crown, is retaining some of the innovations of the covenanting period. The other way in which Charles II's government is actually quite radical rather than conservative, and it's radical again in the direction of retaining what the Covenanters had done, is in its military capacity. Because previous Stuart kings had virtually no military capacity of their own from Scotland. Charles II does. He has a standing army. So he's the first Scottish monarch to have a peacetime standing army, and it will persist throughout his reign. It's not very big, about 3,000 men at its peak later in the reign, but it's there. So that is an innovation, and that again is inspired by the militarism of the Covenanting regime. Even more importantly, though, the government creates a militia, which, just as you'd expect, a citizen militia, so ordinary folk can be called up to serve in this militia, which theoretically could be up to 20,000 strong, so a fairly substantial force. And this militia is, or bits of it, it's, I don't think it's ever mustered in its entirety at any one time, but bits of the odd militia unit or what have you, is used very heavily by Charles II's government to do things like ensure the collection of taxes, to do things like scatter field conventicles, basically any tax raising and law and order aims that the government has, it can use the militia to further those aims. And that again looks much more like the covenanting state than it looks like the antebellum Stuart state. So that's another way in which I think we have a government which is presenting itself as a reincarnation of what had happened under Charles I and James VI, but which in reality is tweaking things, retaining things when it thinks that is useful, largely in the direction of expanding the government's authority and expanding the government's coercive capacity. So it's a nice mixture of conservatism and radicalism. I think that is the best way of understanding the settlement that is produced in Scotland by the mid-1660s.
A lot of what you mentioned would definitely be considered the stick of the thing. Did Charles offer a carrot to his Scottish subjects?
Well, I mean, he offers a carrot to some. Those who he perceives as having done him a good turn, so we're talking largely elites here, will be rewarded. So he'll dole out titles, he'll dole out money payments, he'll dole out offices to individuals who he thinks have done him well. For the populace as a whole, I think that the carrot, if it is one, or at least the offer that Charles II gives, is, first of all, restoration of any rights and privileges you might have enjoyed before the Covenanting Revolution. So the royal boroughs, for example, are restored to all the privileges they'd had beforehand. This restoration of jurisdictions is also part of that, because a lot of these jurisdictions were in private hands, the so-called heritable jurisdictions that landlords have just by virtue of being landholders. As part of their charters, they will have a right to hold a court which can punish certain crimes. So again, that's part of the carrot. It's offering you the restoration of rights that you may have lost, certainly in the 1650s, but possibly in the 1640s as well. For the population more generally, though, I think the carrot is an offer of just order. I think what Charles II is saying is that what my government offers you is sort of strong government, and that's one of the points that people discuss a lot, is how powerful, how strong do we need government to be. But the reason that discussion is going on is because people don't want to return to the chaos of the 1640s and 1650s. People just, I think quite understandably, after 20 years of upheaval, would like a bit of peace and quiet. So what Charles II is offering by way of carrot, I suppose, is that nebulous sense of order, of no more chaos, of my government will just keep things ticking over quietly and let us get back to something that looks like normalcy, essentially. And so I think if we're talking about a carrot outside of the elites, who have all sorts of goodies thrown at them, as I've mentioned, for most people, that is the essential carrot, is just get on with your lives without these bullying ministers from the 1640s telling you what to do, without these English soldiers from the 1650s extracting lots of your money and building a citadel down the road. I think it's just, we will give you peace, order, and quiet. And that is, in some ways, the core raison d'etre of Charles II's regime throughout his reign up until 1685, is, I'll give you order, I'll give you security, I'll give you peace. Now, whether that's actually what is delivered is an entirely different question. But I think certainly at the start of the 1660s, when Charles is coming back, that's really what he has to offer, is just peace and order and no more chaos, essentially.
Well, regardless of how much Charles delivered on his policy of peace and order, his brother fails on that account. A lot of listeners will know, 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution occurs. Would you be able to give us an explanation of the Glorious Revolution from the Scottish perspective? Because like so many things in British history, the most well-known version is usually from the English perspective. But Scotland had a very different experience of these events, and I wonder if you could give us a brief rundown of what went on.
Yeah, that word brief is brief. An interesting one. I'll try my best. Basically, the first thing to grasp here is that when James VII becomes king in 1685, he's Catholic, and that's a big problem. But in Scotland, that is offset to some extent by the fact that James had been essentially running Scottish government for Charles II since about 1680. He'd been resident in Edinburgh more or less constantly between 1680 and 1682. And even after going back down to London in 1682, he remains the sort of manager of Scottish affairs for Charles II. And that means that by the time James becomes king, he's well known in Scotland. He's known as somebody who is familiar with Scottish affairs and is interested in Scottish affairs, which is a bit of a novelty for the Scots, frankly, to have a king who's interested in them. And they haven't had that for quite a while. So when he comes in 1685, the result is he's actually quite popular, it seems, or as popular as a Catholic monarch could be in very Protestant Scotland, which is exemplified by two things. First of all, there's a rebellion against him in 1685 by the Earl of Argyll, who had been convicted of treason back in 1681 and been living in the Dutch Republic for most of the interim. Sails back to try and rebel against James in trying to dovetail his rising with the Duke of Monmouth's rising in England, which happens at roughly the same time. But that rising failed, Argyll's rising, I mean, fails very quickly and very completely. It poses no real threat to James VII's government. Add to that, around about the same time, James VII calls his first parliament in 1685, which is almost sickening in its obsequiousness to the king. It says lots of wonderful and nice things about him, says how great he is and how happy they are to be his subjects, and offers him the excise revenue. If you remember, the excise had been granted to Charles II as a lifetime revenue. It's granted to James VII in 1685 forever and ever. So not just for his lifetime, but alienated to the crown forever. And this is offered by the Scottish Parliament as token of its loyalty to James. So James looks in a really good position in Scotland. He's got all these clients, all these supporters. People are generally, he's generally quite popular, what have you. The problem is that just as in England, James is determined to secure toleration for Roman Catholics. He wants Roman Catholics in Scotland to be free of all penal laws. And his thinking seems to be that if he does that, if he frees Catholics from oppressive laws, then all Scots, not all Scots, but a lot of Scots will spontaneously convert to Catholicism because it's so clearly the right religion. So he's looking to remove the restraints on Catholics on the assumption that that will lead to a process of re-Catholicization. And so he does lots of things. He appoints Catholics to important positions in his government. His chief ministers, the Earl of Perth and the Earl of Melfort, are both convert to Catholicism. He does things like builds a Jesuit chapel in Edinburgh, which is extremely provocative. More importantly, though, he tries to get toleration for Catholics pushed through the Scottish Parliament in 1686, which doesn't work. There's resistance, which you would have thought would have been a warning sign, given how obsequious the 1685 Parliament had been. Suddenly the next year, it's not doing what the king wants. You'd have thought that would have been a sign that he needs to slow down, but apparently not, because what James does is dissolves Parliament in 1686, and in the following year introduces Catholic toleration by proclamation, by royal edict. Just says, all my authority as king, I'm removing all the penal laws against Catholics. And actually also, he removes the penal laws against almost all other religious groups, including Presbyterians, which seems to be an effort to curry favour, to get people to accept the toleration of Catholics. What it actually seems to do, and this is work that's recently been done by Alistair Rafe at Edinburgh University, really underlines this. What it seems to do is sort of turbocharge Presbyterian dissent, which, as I mentioned earlier on, seems to have been withering a little bit as we get into the mid-1680s. Suddenly, particularly in the southwest of Scotland, it revives, and we get massive exoduses from the Episcopalian Church to the Presbyterian Church, or to a nascent Presbyterian Church. The problem with that, in terms of the revolution, which we're getting close to now, is that it hollows out James VII's natural support networks, particularly in the Episcopalian Church, which had been the bedrock of royalism under Charles II and for the early part of James VII's reign. Suddenly, the Episcopalian Church is weakened, is hobbled, because all of these people are leaving it, and because it no longer has special status as the one permissible religious grouping in Scotland. So you add that in with the fact that a lot of James's policies, particularly his promotion of Catholics into public office, had annoyed noblemen, who again would have been natural supporters of the monarchy. James had also been trying to interfere in the government of royal boroughs, which annoys royal boroughs, which again might have been a constituency they would have supported him, but won't now. All that means that when we get to 1688, James VII's regime in Scotland is looking pretty friendless. I mean, not completely, but he's annoyed a lot of people through the policies he has pursued, which means that when the Glorious Revolution happens in England and the actual the crucial events of that revolution, that is William of Orange's invasion, James's flight overseas, all that kind of stuff is very much an English story. But it means that when it happens, that gives these opponents of James an opportunity to seize the initiative and to push through a Scottish version of the revolution. So what we have right at the end of 1688, James flees overseas in December of 1688. We get this sort of Presbyterian uprising almost in the southwest of Scotland, which spreads out towards Edinburgh. We end up with Presbyterians pretty much taking over Edinburgh at the end of 1688 and into the start of 1689. And that sort of momentum that Presbyterians build up allows them then to capture control of the Convention of Estates. Now, this is a body, it's a parliament in all but name, that William of Orange calls. He's not yet King of Scots, not being accepted in that position, but he accepts the kind of management of Scottish affairs, given that James has gone away overseas. And in that capacity, calls this Convention of Estates, which is charged with working out what Scotland's going to do now that James has vanished and William is already King of England and as a result, King of Ireland as well, although his authority in Ireland is yet not yet established. And under the guidance of this sort of revolution Presbyterian interest, which has captured control of the Convention of Estates, what we get Scotland pushing through is a fairly radical revolution, a constitutional revolution, much more radical, I think it's fair to say, than what goes through in England. And the crucial period for this is March and April, and maybe into May as well, 1689, when the convention pushes through the bare bones of this revolution, which is exemplified by a document called the Claim of Rights. Sorry, the Claim of Right, in singular, not plural, which declares that James VII, by his mismanagement and his misrule, had forfeited his right to the throne. The word they use is forfaulted, which is a little bit more technical and has been interpreted by some historians as being a little bit more restricted in meaning than the word forfeit. But essentially, it comes to the same thing. James has sort of unmade himself as king because of his misrule, according to the author drafters of the Claim of Right, which means that the crown is vacant and can be offered to William and Mary to become King and Queen of Scots. So what that all gives us, I think, is a picture of the revolution in Scotland, which is in some ways quite reactive in the sense that it's William's invasion of England and James's flight from England that allows the revolution to take place. But underneath that, we have a distinctly Scottish experience of James alienating his natural constituencies throughout his reign, of irritating a lot of people. And then when the moment of revolution comes, we again have this Scottish story of a particular radical grouping, these Presbyterians, seizing the initiative and managing to craft a revolution settlement, which is quite different from what had happened in England and which results in effectively a contractual understanding of monarchy, so that the king has to abide by certain rules. He has responsibilities to his people, as well as a right to rule over them. And at the same time, the constitutional settlement results in a parliament that is massively empowered. The Scottish Parliament, in its final 17-18 years, is on paper a much more powerful institution than it had been under James and Charles, as a result of this sort of distinctively Scottish revolution settlement that's pushed through.
See, a lot of what you mentioned there, the idea that this convention established a contractual relationship with the sovereign,
yeah,
and I also believe they abolished the episcopacy again, just, you know, really hammer that home, like, we don't want bishops, stop it, stop giving us bishops. Is it possible to see the echo of the earlier Scottish Revolution in these events? Are they talking about that? Are they actively saying, this is not what we did, we being Scots, 50 years ago, we did that then, we could do it again now? Are they calling on it? Are they not mentioning it at all? Because it's within living memory.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. And you're right to pick me up on not having mentioned the establishment of a Presbyterian church, because that's core to the revolution. That again is part of the distinctly Scottish experience. But no, it's really interesting because by the time we get to the revolution in 1689 to 1690, in some ways the Covenanting Revolution is a bit of an embarrassment, because I mentioned earlier on that the experience of Charles's and James's reign, what it tends to do is it hives off those radical Presbyterians and makes them look sort of dangerous, makes them look a bit zealous. And the problem for them, I suppose, is that the covenants and the act of covenanting becomes increasingly associated with that fringe grouping. And so what we have, the Presbyterians who are pushing through the revolution in 1689 to 1690 are not these radical ones. These are people who had taken advantage of James's toleration edicts in 1687 and sort of constructed a new Presbyterian church almost. But it was not a covenanting church. And I think it's very interesting that at no point in the revolution settlement does anybody officially say that we are reenacting the covenants here, that we are sort of repeating the revolution of the late 1630s. I mean, there are good reasons for that, aside from the fact that covenanting had become associated with these radicals. If you were to restore the covenants, then you'd be committing yourself to, as far as a lot of Scots were concerned, spreading Presbyterianism throughout England and Ireland as well. And that's on nobody's agenda by the 1690s. But the Solemn League and Covenant had at least implied that from 1643 to 1644. So, in terms of wider political thinking about contractual monarchy, about powers of parliament, again, I'm not sure that we see any explicit attempt to model what's going on in 1689 to 90 on what had happened under the Covenanters. We're certainly seeing people picking up general ideas about limited monarchy that had existed before the Covenanting Revolution, that had gone through the Covenanting Revolution, and that had existed in Charles II's reign as well. But my sense, and others maybe would disagree, but my sense is that is a more general attempt to call back Scottish political philosophy across the early modern period, rather than to zone in on the Covenanting Revolution in particular. So I think you're right, there's a temptation to assume, well, we'd had a revolution around about 1640, we've got another one in 1690, surely these are connected. I'm not sure that most Scots would have accepted that they were connected in anything except a very broad sense that they're both revolutions which empower certain parts of the political system while weakening others. I think the other thing to say, just briefly here, is I mentioned the notion of contractual monarchy. That is challenged at the time. There are people who support the revolution who nonetheless don't think that the claim of right establishes an unambiguously contractual monarchy. They think it's something much more limited than that. And of course, William of Orange himself, or William II, as he now is in Scotland, does not accept that his kingship is contractual. He's quite clear that he'll take the coronation oath that Parliament mandates, but he does not regard this as binding him into a contract. We've got to be a bit careful about taking things like the claim of right at face value. It's a bit muddier than that, and I think that's worth throwing in there, because it underlines the fact that the revolution process can look sometimes extremely radical, but there are elements within that process and opposing it who are a little less clear. But nonetheless, I think throughout all of these groupings, there is no real, or certainly no explicit sense that they are completing the work of 1641. I don't think there's any sense of that. And certainly there is no attempt at all to bring back the covenants and to assure that this Presbyterian church that is established in 1690 is a covenanted church. There's no attempt to do that as well, much to the disappointment, of course, of some of these radical groupings who would have liked to see a covenanted church. But it's, I think it becomes pretty clear that we're pretty clear pretty quickly that is not what anybody more broadly outside of these groupings is actually interested in.
And that's really interesting. You mentioned that a lot of people are drawing from earlier works of Scottish political thought. Do we see them quoting or using people from the earlier revolution? So Johnston of Warriston or Samuel Rutherford or anyone like that? Are they using their work but linking it to earlier non-Covenanter sources as sort of like this is a Scottish political thought, political heritage of our relationship with monarchy and with government? Or do they just not mention them at all?
I'm not aware of them mentioning them prominently. I mean, there might be other scholars who are more expert who would be able to correct me on that. I think what we see instead is the emergence of this rhetoric, which had been bubbling away throughout the early modern period, but I think becomes very much more prominent in the revolutionary era. Rhetoric of sort of public opinion, of the inclinations of the people, of this kind of almost an attempt to claim that what the revolution is doing is sort of giving life to natural law or natural justice in Scotland. That's for example, that is the basis on which the Presbyterian Church is re-established, is because it is the natural inclination of the people to want a Presbyterian Church. Now that's very questionable, and people do question it at the time. But that's the rhetoric. So I think we more see that than any explicit callbacks to previous thinkers. And I think there's quite a good reason for that, because if you look at the most prominent sort of theorists of limited or contractual monarchy, not just in the Covenanting period, but earlier, people like George Buchanan. A lot of their ideas are fairly radical about in terms of rights of resistance. So it is one thing in the 1690s to say that there is a contract between the monarch and his people. And we're defining people here in narrowed sense as the political elites. It's not Joe Bloggs down the street who's included in this. It's the elite. But nonetheless, there's a difference between that and saying, well, that means that these people have a right to resist the monarch should he break the contract. And I think there is a reluctance to make that what looks to us, I suppose, like a fairly obvious legal. You know, what's the point in a contract if people can't enforce it? But nonetheless, that is a step too far for a lot of people in the 1690s. And I think the problem with a lot of these earlier theorists, and this goes for Covenanting political thought during the Restoration as well, is that step of enshrining a right to resistance looks uncomfortably radical for a lot of people, which might explain why it is easier for people framing the revolution and justifying the revolution to rely on things like natural inclinations or ancient practice or whatever, than it is to try and invoke specific pieces of political philosophy. But again, I will defer to other scholars who have made a more detailed study of political thought, because there are others who have done that. But certainly my sense is that we're not necessarily seeing really detailed mining of previous political philosophy to justify the revolution. It's a bit more naturalistic, I suppose, and a bit vaguer than that.
Well, as we bring this lovely chat to a close, we'll finish with, you know, one of the more famous Scottish events, 1707. Does the 1630-1640 revolution, the Covenanter revolution, does this come up now? Or is it much like the case with the Glorious Revolution? It's not mentioned at all by either opponents or supporters. Is it at all relevant to the debates going on in the Scottish Parliament?
My sense is no, not really. Again, there are others who've made a closer study of the Union debates who might disagree. But I think the Union debates, when they come, focus on much more immediate issues. I mean, there is strong Presbyterian interest in the Union debates, obviously. A lot of Presbyterians are in favour of Union because they see it as a way of protecting the Church. I mean, there are others who are suspicious. They worry that it might undermine the Church. But these are not Presbyterians. These are the Presbyterians that I mentioned earlier on who are not calling back to the Covenanting Revolution. So they're not, I don't think, really talking about the Covenanting period. I mean, similarly for most other people who are getting involved in the Union debates, they've got other issues that they're much more worried about. They're much more worried about commerce. You know, how do we protect or expand Scottish commerce? How do we ensure that we protect the liberties we have won as a result of the revolution? How do we sort of protect privileges that certain groups in society have? So, you know, the royal boroughs, how do you ensure that they don't lose their trading privileges, for example, or what trading privileges they still have by this point? And also, the one of the things that really underpins a lot of this debate is the fallout from the Darien scheme. So how will that play into, or how does that play into to union? What do we need to get out of union for, you know, redress for that? All of which is a long way of saying, I think, that when the union debate comes, it's informed by the revolution of 1689 to 90. You know, what are the implications of that? How do we protect the gains of that revolution? And how does that play into union? I don't detect much call back to the earlier revolution, apart from among these hardline Covenanters who are still there in the background, kind of muddling along. And they obviously are still interested in the Covenants and the Covenanting Revolution, but they are very much a fringe by this point. So I think it's a tale of two revolutions, really, by the time we get to the Union. The Glorious Revolution is really important to the Union debates, directly or indirectly. The Covenanting Revolution, I'm not so sure, is still regarded as something that needs to be, certainly by mainstream debate, is not really something that I think that is regarded as requiring to be taken into consideration as we approach Union.
Dr. Alan Kennedy, was there a Scottish Revolution?
That is an interesting question, and I suppose it depends what you mean by Scottish. I mean, there is a revolution in between 1637 and 1641. I don't think there's any doubt about that. There is a massive change in the basic fundamental structures of the Scottish state. So in that sense, yes, there's clearly a Scottish Revolution. I mean, it ends up running into the ground, so it doesn't last, you know, forever. But I think there's definitely a revolution. The problem is, I think, over that Scottish part, because what happens in Scotland in 1637 to 41, and then what happens throughout the 1640s and 1650s, is so heavily bound up with what's going on elsewhere in the British Isles. I mean, I don't think you get the Covenanting movement without multiple monarchy, without the fact that Charles I is also King of England and King of Ireland. And equally, you don't get a successful revolution. You don't get the Covenanters winning the Two Bishops' Wars without the British context, without Charles I finding his resources hobbled by the political crisis in England. And also the subsequent course of the revolution after 1641 makes no sense at all unless you understand the British context. So I think the way I would frame this is, there is a Scottish Revolution, clearly, but we have to see it as one component of a much wider series of British revolutions that are also happening, which means, unfortunately, understanding this period, I think more so than almost any other period in early modern history, requires you to understand not just Scotland, but what's going on elsewhere. So yes, to a Scottish Revolution, but only within the wider umbrella of British revolutions going on at the same time.
What a fantastic answer to end up on. That was wonderful. So if listeners are interested in reading or following more of your work, is there anything you'd recommend, anywhere they can keep up to date?
Yes. I mean, the most obvious way to find me is through my staff web pages at the University of Dundee. So I have a web page there on the University of Dundee's website, and that lists my research interests. So it tells you about how I'm interested in late 17th century Scotland, themes of politics, crime, migration in particular. Also talks about the Privy Council project, which I'm involved in too. For, you know, more light relief, I'm also on Twitter. So if you want to get an insight into my day-to-day ruminations, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm not sure I'd recommend it, but it is there. But certainly if you go to my university web pages, you'll find links to some of my work as well, if you're interested in reading up more. The other thing I should say, and I always feel the need to plug this, is that one of my other hats is that I work with History Scotland magazine. I'm the consultant editor of that. They again have a website, and they also have the magazine, obviously. That's a really good place for people to go as a general resource on Scottish history. The magazine itself is even if I do say so myself, is a wonderful publication which presents cutting edge research in all aspects of Scottish history, heritage and archaeology for general public consumption. And you'll see my hand hovering over a lot of what you find in there. So those are the best ways to find me, either through History Scotland or through my institutional web pages at the University of Dundee.
I mean, I would echo that and highly, highly recommend History Scotland. It's brilliant. I would also recommend your Twitter because it's very engaging, it's very entertaining. And it's a lot of modern politics on it, but you link it back to historical relevance. Mm. And I think that's a very valuable perspective. And I would highly, highly recommend it. And there'll be a link to that, to all of that, in the show notes of this episode. Dr. Alan Kennedy, thank you so much for coming on. This has been wonderful.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it greatly.
This episode is made possible by PwC. It's getting hot out here. Moving the mercury can help move your business. PwC helps turn sustainability theory into real-world action. Reduce your carbon footprint while increasing transparency in net zero commitments. Start with reporting to identify your climate risks and reinvent your business. Create a more sustainable business and a stronger planet. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at thenewequation.com.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.